Kildare Focus with Owen Beattie.
But to start this afternoon, there was a 55% increase last year in the number of people attending support services at Bodywise, the Eating Disorders Association of Ireland. According to latest figures, emails to the Bodywise service from people seeking help for their eating disorders also increased significantly from 71% or by 71% in 2021. Well, Ellen Jennings is Communications Officer with Bodywise and she joins us now. Good afternoon to you, Ellen, and thanks for taking our call.
Hi, Owen. Thanks for having me on.
I think as we always preface interviews like this, we say that, you know, on the one hand, it's worrying the number of people that are coming forward with eating disorders, but on the other hand, it's encouraging and positive that they are seeking that help.
Yeah, absolutely. To see more people reaching out hopefully means that that stigma around eating disorders is being reduced a little bit, but also it is concerning to see so many people coming forward having been affected. And that stigma is something that's been around for a long time. In the past, it has been thought that eating disorders kind of affect people of a particular age or gender, but in reality, we know that this is something that can affect anyone at any stage in their life. As you've mentioned, we've seen an increase in people coming forward on our services for support, but that's also the case in hospitals as well, presenting with eating disorders.
I think what we really have come to learn over the last few years as well that's really been brought to light is that eating disorders is not as black and white as maybe we thought it might have been years ago. There are so many different ranges and it's a spectrum, isn't it, eating disorders? People can be affected in different ways.
Yeah, I suppose what you're saying there about it being a spectrum, the difference between what we would call kind of normal disordered behaviours that can often be perpetuated by this kind of diet culture that we live in that are normalised in a way all around us. Often people engage in behaviours like dieting and other restrictive behaviours around food and exercise. But when it steps over into eating disorder territory is when it is compulsive. It's something that the person can't not do in order to feel okay. And that's the thing about an eating disorder. It's a coping mechanism for dealing with other things in their life that the person might not be able to cope with. So in this way, the eating disorder offers them a sense of control over things that might feel out of control.
Explain the term to me, binge eating disorder. I think this is only recently classified as an eating disorder, and it may be a new term to some people. What does that mean?
Yeah, so binge eating disorder is one of the three main diagnosed eating disorders. And what happens for someone affected by binge eating disorder, they'll often experience this intense urge to binge, and there's often or overeat, and it's this loss of control over the amount and speed that they consume the food, and it often goes past the point of comfortable fullness. And then there's the following feelings of shame and guilt associated with that. So oftentimes these binge episodes can be following on from a period of restriction or a period of dieting. And that's a combination of the physical and mental restriction. The person can then have an urge to binge. So unlike bulimia nervosa, which is another commonly diagnosed eating disorder, which can involve binge eating as well, with binge eating disorder, there generally isn't that purging behaviour after the person binges. So there's a lot of sense of shame and embarrassment around the binge, which means that the person can kind of do so in a secretive way and it can go unnoticed. And the person can become kind of trapped in a cycle of binging, dieting, the feelings of guilt and shame, and that can be really isolating for someone.
Yeah, and I note as well, Ellen, that attendance at the Bodywise support group, Peer-Led Resilience, which helps people struggling with eating disorders but also their families and carers, increased by 125% as well. So that highlights that eating disorders, while it affects the person themselves who are engaged in the behaviour, it also has that knock-on effect by, impacting family members or friends or carers who may be worried about the person.
Yeah, what the Pillar Programme is all about is learning how to support someone and come alongside them in their recovery journey. So whether that's opening up the conversation about what might be going on for the person, all towards communication, listening and dealing with different emotions that the person might be experiencing. So it's for family members, for siblings, for partners, and the new pillar support programme is starting this Wednesday. So it's a 4-week programme. That's a free programme to attend. So if you're interested in attending that, you can email pillar@bodywise.ie. That's pillar@bodywise.ie.
Okay, and just before we let you go then, Ellen, I want to talk to you about maybe misconceptions that there are out there about eating disorders, because I think unless you have either dealt with it yourself or know somebody that has dealt with it, it can kind of seem like something that is maybe flippantly spoken about, where, you know, well, could they not stop eating, or could they not eat more, or something like that. That is so damaging to people who are struggling with eating disorders, is it not?
Absolutely. We know that food and dieting and that is a symptom of what's really going on for the person. So that control over food is kind of what you see on the outside, but underneath there's a lot going on for the person in terms of the emotions that they're experiencing. And it's also important to remember that there's no one look of what an eating disorder looks like either. So there is kind of stigmas that exist that prevent people from coming forward for help because they don't meet the, you know, stereotypical look of what people think an eating disorder looks like. So eating disorders exist in people of all different shapes and sizes, and, you know, everyone's exists deserving of the same type of care regardless of their shape or size. So the physical symptoms are what we see on the outside, but the psychological symptoms tend to be similar, and the person needs to engage in that psychological and emotional support regardless of the type of eating disorder that they have.
Okay, remind us, if people want to get in touch with Bodywise, the best way to do it. You might give out that email address for the Pillar program as well, which is essentially for those family members or carers or friends who want to get in touch, as well as that person who has the eating disorder, and also a phone number perhaps as well, Ellen.
Yeah, so it's important to say, I suppose, that you don't need a diagnosis to use our support services. And whether you're concerned about someone or if it's you yourself, you know, you don't have to say much. Often we'll just get a couple of words or a line, and that's just to start the conversation, you know. So on our email support, that's alex@bodywise.ie. So that's alex@bodywise.ie. So that's the email support line, just to chat things through. The helpline then is 01-210-7906. So 01-210-7906. And then the Pillar Family Support Programme, so that's not for the person with the eating disorder, but for the people who are supporting them. That's Pillar, P-I-L-A-R, at bodywise.ie. And there's more information about that on our website.
Super stuff. I think it's great that you provide so many fantastic services out there, and it's always good to talk to you on the programme and highlight it as well. That is Ellen Jennings, Communications Officer with Bodywise. And just to give out those details again, the email address, if you want email support, it's alex@bodywise.ie, and Bodywise is spelled BODYWHYS.ie. The Pillar support service is PILAR pillar@bodywise.ie, and the number as well for that helpline for Bodywise is 01-210-7906. And thanks indeed to Ellen Jennings, Communications Officer with the organisation, for joining us on the programme this afternoon.
Kildare Focus with Owen Beattie.
Now, the union representing the majority of health and social care support therapists in special schools is writing to Minister Anne Rabbitt to raise concerns about a lack of engagement about the reinstatement of 220 positions in schools. Ms Rabbitt, who has responsibility for disability, announced on Friday that a process has been commenced by the HSE to reinstate such therapists in schools that previously had them. The roles include physiotherapists and speech and language therapists. Well, on the line is Linda Kelly, National Secretary of the Forsa Trade Union with responsibility for health and social care professionals. Linda, good afternoon and welcome to the programme.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just give me the background to this and what has got us to this stage at the moment. And has that letter been written now to Minister Anne Rabbitt?
So it's issued today to the Minister. I think what's important to understand is that there is no disagreement about the need for these posts in schools. We know that there are children and young adults with highly complex needs who require a multi disciplinary approach. And the union very much welcomed the reinstatement of these posts. What has become very problematic, and this has been an issue that has been simmering really, I think, right throughout the COVID period, is that there is an absolute lack of engagement and a lack of meaningful engagement from the HSE with FORSA around how this decision is going to be implemented. The people who are currently working on the teams providing frontline services are our members, and they are telling me that there is a retention crisis. They are telling me that there is a recruitment crisis. And so the maths don't add up about where we're going to get people to fill these posts from. And my biggest concern in all of this is that actually families are going to be left with another failed government promise. And all of that can be avoided if the HSE actually come and talk to the staff who are delivering the service.
Okay, so Linda, has there been any engagement then whatsoever, I suppose, in recent weeks or months since you've started to raise this issue?
So we did get a letter from the HSE, to be fair, advising us that the government had made this decision and that they would convene an engagement without delay, you know. And suddenly there was no meetings been convened. And I have written back, I had separately written outlining the concerns about the service. We would clearly see that the service as it stands, without any new investment in it, is in crisis. We have therapists who are leaving the service because of the issues in it, and the HSE seem to believe that a high-profile international recruitment campaign will solve all problems. I don't believe, and our members certainly don't believe, that that will bring in enough people to staff the service. But even if that were to happen, by miracle of miracles, the staff wouldn't stay in the service because there are too many issues in how it's been put together. And that's something that has to be addressed.
A note as well on Friday, Anne Rabbitt said that the HSE plan around the latest decision included the reassigning of existing HSE staff to fill a third of the roles this month, with a further one third to be filled from existing panels and further reassignment through this autumn. She said that other initiatives, including a high profile international recruitment campaign, will get underway immediately. How confident are you about what the Minister has said there?
If they want to reassign existing staff in the service, all it is doing is robbing Peter to pay Paul. Like, what we know is that in most services, the number of staff and vacancies could be as high as 50%. So what are you going to do? You're going to take 30% of half of what's meant to be there at the moment, which means that kids who are not attending special schools or kids who are in other areas, that they're not going to get services. That doesn't work for anybody. And I think the government really need to look at how they're treating not just the staff in the service who are critical to delivery, but also the families and people with disabilities, because they deserve to be prioritised. They deserve to have a comprehensive service with all of the therapies that they require. And I think it's really now beholden on the HSE to engage with staff representatives to make sure that that happens.
And finally, Linda, what's happening to those children then in certain schools, for example, who need those social care support therapists or healthcare support therapists and are not getting them? Are they missing out on that, or are other people having to fill that void?
Well, I think they are absolutely missing out, which is why we need to get these issues fixed as quickly as possible. But I think what it is that oftentimes families are having to resort to pay privately for support. And that is not something that should be happening in a modern Ireland. This is a publicly funded service provided by public servants because it's for a common good for all people with disabilities. And I think we just now need to get in a room and fix this for the families involved and for the staff providing the service.
FORSA Trade Union raising concerns over the lack of engagement on therapists for special schools. And Linda Kelly is National Secretary of the Trade Union with responsibility for health and social care professionals. Linda, thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thanks, Owen.
Kildare Focus with Owen Beattie.
Okay, now a support group for people who hear voices is being set up in the Leinster area, and it's going to be held in Enfield in Hotwell Farm in County Meath, just over the border, but taking in people from all across Leinster. And it's been organised by Hearing Voices Network Ireland, and also my next guest on the programme this afternoon, Becky Wilkinson. Becky, good afternoon. You're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Darren.
Tell us a little bit then about the reason for setting up this group, and explain to us who is impacted and what you aim to do.
So my main reason to come on the show really is to raise awareness and stop the stigma around voice hearing and other unusual experiences. I mean, call it what you will, it's like psychotic breaks. Some people think get diagnosed with all sorts of things, labels, and you know, being labeled, and some people need this and are reassured by the diagnosis. But other people prefer not to go down the psychiatry route or take any medication. So I guess it's trying to help people who are in that situation, who are not knowing what they're, you know, experiencing, who are not fully understanding it, and who want the support that's out there. And there is tons of support. It's just looking for it and realizing that it's there. And my, you know, my guest speaker who's coming to open the group and who's coming to launch it is Jackie Dillon, and she's had her own experiences. She's had a lived experience. She's literally been through the trauma. She's been through a lot of, she's heard voices all her life. She's an amazing woman, and she's very inspiring. And it's really to talk about her, because she's just, you know, but and basically the hearing voice movement itself, because she is at the forefront, you know, of the movement in the UK. It was set up by Marius Rom and Sandra Esker and Patsy Hedge in 1987. So not that long ago, but there's been a lot of stigma, and I guess a lot of people trying to, not sabotage, but it's like it hasn't really taken off because there hasn't been the right kind of steering, I guess. And but she's such an inspiration herself, and she's always trying to help people who've been, you know, who've had this lived experience and who are hearing voices or having these unusual experiences. I mean, I guess I could discuss a little bit. My own experience was that I heard voices, one voice as a child when I was quite young, and it was a female voice, and I never really understood why she was there, but she used to come on sometimes when I was alone in a room, and it was always a female voice that just sort of talked to me, and I was always trying to get it out of my head. But, you know, I didn't hear a voice for years. But then I had a bit of an experience with that. I had tuberculosis back in 2015, and I was put on very, you know, heavy-duty medication. And I guess what I experienced was quite unusual. I had unusual things happening to me, and you know, there was just strange experiences that I couldn't really explain. And now I had done a psychoanalysis degree about 25 years ago, which was amazing. I really sort of understood that was the kind of area that I was really interested in, kind of how the mind works and all of that. And that was amazing to have done that. And then, you see, I took off and did, you know, a few years. I didn't realise, I didn't really have what I felt was the experience under my belt to kind of go on with that. And it also requires going through your own therapy. And I felt really that I wasn't quite ready for that. I was quite young and I wanted to be adventurous. And so I went off and did various things, including doing a lot of travelling, because I had done Ballymaloe. And then because of my TB experience and everything that happened after, which, by the way, took a few years to kind of get back on track, I then decided to do my master's in psychoanalytic psychotherapy. I also met Jackie Dillon around this time, and I joined the Hearing Voices Network Ireland board. So I'm on the board, and we've got, you know, there's a lot of support for the cause, but it's basically trying to get the message out there that if people are struggling, that, you know, there is the support there. You just have to find the right support.
And just to stop you on there, Becky, and to pick up on that point, that, you know, hearing voices, some people might not understand that hearing voices, seeing things and other unusual experiences are a common response to stress or anxiety. And the peer support group is open to everyone who has these experiences, but is also, I suppose, set up to highlight that this is a very real experience that people do go through. So,
oh, absolutely. And Jackie would say, you know, people can be very distressed by the experience, and to know that, you know, other people do, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are experiencing that. In apparently in Ethiopia alone, about 80% of the population actually hear voices. Now, I don't know if that's because they've had such, so much trauma or what it is, because she would say a lot of people who do have these experiences may have suffered from trauma in, you know, obviously in early life, or even things that they mightn't have understood that they've been through, that kind of thing. So, and that's, you know, but there is a lot of support out there for that. And I guess the thing about it is when people do hear voices, they don't really understand, is it coming from inside my head? Some people have them inside their head. Some people have to hear them externally. And, you know, a lot of people would say that, you know, in actual fact, probably most people have heard a voice at some point in their life, or that they don't understand where it's come from or whatever. And other people perceive that their thoughts might be something like that. And it's very interesting. So it's fascinating the way the mind works. And I think her take on it would be that if you hear voices, or if you have these unusual experiences, like might be that you have tactile, you know, things that you feel, like you might have sensations or other unusual things that you don't necessarily understand why you're having them. It's very important to realise that you're not alone, that there are many, many people who have this kind of experience. Yeah. And Jackie's whole thing is that there's so much support in the UK. I think there's about, I can't remember how many support groups she said there was, about 270 or something. And, you know, here we have very few, and particularly because of COVID, a lot of them have closed down and there just isn't the support out there. And she would say that having the support, the group support, is ultimately what really helps people. Because I guess when people are having the shared experiences where they're talking about their experiences, there are other people who might, you know, understand because they've been through the same thing. And I guess it's a bit like AA for people who hear voices. You know, they're literally coming together. They're discussing their experiences. They're feeling reassured. There's someone out there, by the way, who's had exactly that experience. And, you know, that'll, you know, save me from all, you know, going through all this turmoil. And, you know, that I think is the most powerful thing. I mean, there are other methods that have been known to work. So there is something called the Maastricht interview, which is basically where you engage with your voices and you're supposed to basically ask them who they are, why they're there, and various other things. There's also another thing which is called open dialogue, which is another method of trying to, I think it's introducing, I'm not so sure what it exactly involves. I just know it's supposed to be very effective. And it's basically where you bring in your family, and it's, you know, there's lots of discussion around what you've experienced and all of that kind of thing.
Becky, I suppose the other thing is that some people would be afraid that if they were to come forward and say that they were hearing these voices or having these experiences, that perhaps they wouldn't be believed. Or, you know, it's very hard for somebody who is not having that experience to understand. What people are going
through. Exactly. And I think that's the ultimate problem is that there's a lot of misconception and misunderstanding around it. And, you know, there's a lot of labeling, as I was saying, and some people prefer to have a label. Oh, great, then that means I have psychosis, or I have schizophrenia, and that means I'll be on the right medication. And that's fine. Some people would like to go down that route. But this is basically me saying that that's not for everyone. Some people would prefer not to be labeled, not to have the stigma, just to say, actually, I think my experience is different. I do know lots of people who also think they're going through a spiritual experience, which I know for me, that was my thing. And there is lots of support in that sense too. For example, there's the shamanic people who believe that what you're going through is a spiritual emergency. So there is that too, that if people think they're having a spiritual experience, because even when I've been studying my psychoanalysis, Jung would say that it's like we have a collective unconscious that we're all tapping into, the ones who have these experiences. And it could be something outside ourselves that we don't fully understand, but that, you know, from my point of view, I believe that there is this kind of collective consciousness where people tap into something, and particularly mediums, and that's how they might get their information, is that they're literally drawing it from, you know, this universal sort of memory, let's say.
Yeah.
And it's helping them sort of know stuff, you know, obviously to retrieve information about people, that kind of thing. And I've sort of certainly had an experience like that myself, where when I've done Reiki on people, I for some reason would know information about them, and I never know where it comes from. And it could be a voice, or it could be an urge, or it could be just words that come out of my mouth. And I never understand where that's coming from. And I've actually done a shamanic practitioner's course myself, And that has also been very helpful with these kind of unusual experiences.
All right. And this, as I said from the outset, this meeting is taking place on the 14th of September between 5 and 6 o'clock at the studio on the Hotwell Farm in Enfield, just over the border. It's the Leinster Area Group Launch for Hearing Voices Network Ireland. If people want to get in touch, they can contact you, Becky, directly. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's very important that people do contact me, because, I mean, it's very important that they have my contact details, because there will be limited spaces available. And I really want to reach out to those who are having issues with their voices and stuff. And I really want them to understand that if they're having issues and they need the support, that we are there for them, and we are literally trying to set up support groups around the country so that there will be much more support readily available.
So the number to contact you on then, Becky, is 086-320-6722. That's 086-320-6722. Or you can email hvnleinster@gmail.com. That's hvnleinster@gmail.com. And that launch taking place in Enfield between 5 and 6 o'clock on the 14th of September. But get in touch with Becky for more details. Becky Wilkinson, many thanks for joining us on the programme this afternoon.
Many thanks, Owen. Bye.
Now to move on, Children's Minister Roderick O'Gorman is to be called before an Oireachtas committee to explain why a promised independent review of mother and baby home testimony was scrapped. Chair of the Children's Committee, Kathleen Funchen, has said she'll be asking the minister to account for his decision, which has sparked anger among survivors. And indeed, we covered this with Breda Murphy when the news broke earlier last week. She's the PRO of the Tuam Mother and Baby Home Alliance, and she joins us again. Good afternoon to you, Breda.
Afternoon, Owen.
I suppose this is welcome from your point of view. Again, it doesn't cover over the anger and distress that survivors of these institutions have had to deal with over the last couple of days. But maybe we might get an explanation now from Roderick O'Gorman.
That's what I'm hoping, because the Children's Committee have been the one tool that we've had at our disposal. Those who are on the Children's Committee, for instance, are Holly Kearns, who's a Social Democrat from Cork, Patrick Costello, Cathal Crowe, Alan Dillon, here, he's beside me in Castlebar, I'm in Galway. Kathleen Funchen is the chair. Sean Sherlock spoke with me on drive time, and he was the one who instigated this, who said that it warranted the minister to come and explain why at this point they've decided to scrap it. But it looks like the decision was taken much earlier indeed to scrap it, and the fact that we have not been told. And then you also have senators on the committee. So basically at committee hearing, the minister comes in, and the members of the committee will seek from us any questions that we want asked of the minister, and they can pose those to him. And it is a full hearing where we get to watch on the Oireachtas TV. It's unlikely to be a closed hearing. So I think now the invitation will go out to him. There's a procedure for it. It may take a couple of weeks, and he has to accept as well. But I think it will go ahead. And while it may not change an awful lot, it will at least give clarity as to why he did not engage with us to tell us and why he chose this course of action.
Okay, so just bear with me for a moment, Breda, while I explain the background behind this. So in June 2021, Mr. O'Gorman announced plans to bring proposals to Cabinet to reappoint an international human rights expert to re-examine the testimony given to the Mother and Baby Homes Commission and to report back this year. The commitment came after a member of the Commission of Investigation admitted these personal stories had been discounted because they were provided in private and not under oath. While a draft memo to appoint an international expert was drawn up by Roderick O'Gorman, it did not progress any further. The Department of Children recently confirmed that the plan to appoint an international independent expert to re-examine the testimony provided by 500 people to the confidential committee is no longer going ahead. So that's what brings us up to date to now, Breda, is that this is not going ahead.
Exactly. There were 550 who gave their testimony to the confidential committee. Now, some of them were our members. And basically what happened, they could give it in Galway City, for instance. Two people travelled to meet with them. They went in, they spoke, and they were asked a series of questions. And then a document was filled out as they were answering those questions. So it was sort of paraphrased if it was to be included. Then there was another section which was where 64 people were able to give their testimony to the investigative committee, and that was much more adversarial, where they would be asked questions about their testimony. But they were not given, none of the 550 or the 64 were given their testimony afterwards. So when they left, I had one lady, for instance, say, can I gather my evidence so that I look through it and make sure I haven't left out anything? And I rang the then legal expert at the commission's office, and they would not allow that. So from the outset, it appeared to me as a tick box exercise, because nobody could understand how you give testimony to an Oireachtas statutory set up commission, and then you cannot retrieve that to ensure that you've not left anything out, when in fact you are the victim survivor. Mm. And the whole reason for the setup, Owen, was because for decades after decade, the state narrative had always survived. Basically, the state had decided what had happened. They never took the views of mothers of children as to their experiences. So this was to balance that with the voices of the victim survivor. And of course, when the commission themselves admitted that they did not use 550 or so testimonies from the confidential committee, simply because they were not robust enough to stand up to scrutiny, or that they said they were contaminated, and that, in other words, survivors may have spoken to one another and may have... It was placing an assertion on the evidence not being able to be used. Mm. Yes, every person who was from the religious order or from the state, which was the local councils or whatever, they were given a copy of their testimony. But also, there was no wording as to contamination of their evidence, when in fact the state, the commissions themselves found that evidence provided in relation to Castle Pollard, Shanross Abbey and Besborough and Cork, where the sisters, you know, the facility operated until 1970, which is not that long ago, and yet they could not say where upwards of 1,000 children were laid to rest.
Okay,
you know,
just
so
before,
they found that speculative and misleading, the commission said.
Before we let you go, Breida, we mentioned from the outset now that Kathleen Funchan, the chair of the Children's Committee, she's quoted here in the Examiner saying that she's going to write to Minister O'Gorman to call him in before the coming weeks. She says, I think it's important that he's asked a question in a public forum and he answers the question in a public forum. I think it's important for him to give a reason. She added, I will be suggesting to the committee and I would be hopeful the committee will be agreeable that we have the minister in. Sean Sherlock, who's also a committee member, said that Mr. O'Gorman must attend as soon as possible to provide clarity to survivors of mother and baby homes. You'd be calling for that now, same as Sean Sherlock, as soon as possible to start getting answers, Breida.
Absolutely. We need answers. We need to know why the state, time and again, regardless of what redress, what manner of redress is coming, why they always disbelieve the survivor, why they place survivors, whether it's Louise O'Keefe with the Department of Education, some physiotomy survivors, the onus, Magdalene Laundrie's, the onus all the time is for those people as children to provide evidence of the abuse they suffered. Now, in relation to Magdalene Holmes, some of the children who went in, and some went from Tuam, County Galway, to the Magdalene Laundrie in Galway, they went as children, as very young girls, and they had to provide evidence of them being there. If they were in an institution from their date of birth, from, you know, born, right up until maybe 16 or 18 years of age, they had no access to that documentation, and they do not now. The state closed its archives from them, and also the religious orders have not. And they were found negligent in that. They were actually rapped on the knuckles for that previously. And the one good thing we have behind us is that we have the United Nations Committee for Torture looking at the Magdalen women, and in particular Elizabeth Coppin's case. She had been in three homes between 1964 to 1968, three Magdalen homes. And so she was abused in those homes, and the state did not fully investigate. So that case is pending. It's before the European courts.
Okay.
So this is what we need. We need clarity, we need transparency, and we need to understand why the state continuously subjects survivors of abuse under state care or under religious care to such treatment that would not be tolerated elsewhere.
Okay, Breda Murphy, PRO of the Tuam Mother and Baby Home Alliance, thanks as always for your time this afternoon, and we will continue to cover this here on KFM. That is Breda Murphy reacting to the news that Minister Roderick O'Gorman is to be called before the Children's Committee to explain the mother and baby home decision.